Welcome to the Barnes Review History Hour. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, March 18th, 2022. The Barnes Review History Hour is a program where I will be interviewing contributors to the Barnes Review History Magazine, a bi-monthly print and digital publication dedicated to bringing history into accord with the facts. Today I am joined by Paul Angel, the executive editor of the Barnes Review. All right, Paul Angel, welcome to the program, sir. How are you?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you very much for joining me. This is long overdue. You are the executive editor of the Barnes Review History Magazine, and you are also the managing editor of American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. And of course, I always encourage all of our listeners to subscribe to these fine print publications. And to get started, since this is the first time you've been a guest with me, I'd like for you to kind of talk about your background quick and how you got involved with the magazine and the newspaper.
Thanks, John. It's glad to be here. Well, listen, I've always been interested in history as a child and the myths of the Norsemen and the Romans and the Greeks and the history of Egypt and all this stuff. But it was really not my focus. My focus as a young man was in graphic design and marketing. Although I did take quite a few art history classes to get that degree. And I learned a lot from that about the real world through sculptures, the evolution of artwork through time, a reflection of the cultures and civilizations that they represent. And I also had a particular affinity, of course, for European artwork and culture because I'm a white man, a Christian. And so I got a job years and years ago in 1993 looking for a job. And my job placement agent sent me over to a place called Liberty Lobby. Liberty Lobby was on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. at the time. I'll make the long story short because we could have an entire program on the events at the Spotlight in American Free Press. Spotlight in Liberty Lobby while I was there. But while I was there then, I started doing graphic design for them, became very interested in the newspaper and history magazine. And the publisher at the time was Willis Carter, who had started Liberty Lobby in 1955 and Spotlight in 1975. Had a really decent circulation at one point in time at the Spotlight, upwards of 400,000 people. That was before my time. But he got so influential, and so many people were reading it. This was literally, I mean, those numbers would place him in one of the top 20 paid circulation newspapers today. So they were very interesting things happened there. But I also started working with the Barnes Review History Magazine, and slowly but surely, I began writing some articles for them. Wrote an article on the pagan origins of Santa Claus. Wrote a two-part article on the mysterious megaliths in New England. That's another one we could have an entire show on. And slowly but surely, you know, the organization came under attack because of the number of subscribers that Willis had acquired for both of these publications. And then the powers that be didn't like what we were saying. We were equal opportunity smashers, smashing up Republicans, Democrats, debt, pushing America First policies long before Donald Trump ever considered running for president, secure borders, sound money policy, honest elections, all the things that are still so important today were all being discussed by both of these publications. But somewhere around 2001, after a multiple year legal battle, Liberty Lobby was put out of business and was unable to publish the Spotlight. So a bunch of us got together and we started the American Free Press. And so that newspaper has now been going for 20 years, which is quite a feat, actually, when you think about it, an independent newspaper on a shoestring budget, considering nowadays organizations like The Times and The Post are losing millions of dollars a month. And, of course, the Barnes Review was still around because it was not involved in the lawsuit that took down the Spotlight. And as time went on, I moved into different positions in the publications. And as Willis passed away in 2015 and many of our other prominent writers and others either went to other jobs or passed away, honestly, because it was an older group. Then a couple of us were still around to try to carry this thing on into the future. And that is my story in a nutshell.
Very interesting. Yeah, no, that's fascinating. So you go way back to the Liberty Lobby and Spotlight days. And, you know, I remember first hearing about, I think the first time I came across either American Free Press or the Barnes Review, was running into and listening to Michael Collins Piper, his radio programs on RBN. And I was immediately struck. I was like, oh, wow, there's actually, you know, publications and organizations dedicated to engaging in revisionism and, you know, publishing a populist America First, you know, sort of nationalist newspaper. And I've always been very interested in journalism and you know, reading newspapers. I remember like in high school, I would wake up before I'd even go to school and devour the whole entire newspaper of the hometown that I lived in at the time. So I've always been interested in newspapers, and I found American Free Press and have been a huge supporter and fan ever since. And it's really been an honor to contribute to not only the newspaper, but also the magazine. Well, so you said, go ahead.
I was going to say, we've always been looking for younger people, and that for us, younger people is anybody under 50, to help right? us carry this on. And not a lot of people want to do that because there's some dangers associated with that. Including you know, attacks on your reputation, attacks on your finances, attacks on your organization. And so it's this is a good time to announce that, John, that of course this is our first show for the for you taking over for Dr. Edward DeVries for the TBR History Hour. And it was on hiatus for a few months trying to find somebody who had the talent and the willingness to interview politically incorrect guests and talk about politically incorrect publications. So we're very happy to have you on board and to have you working also on our print publication, which is still our bread and butter. And I should tell people that do listen, we also have a PDF version of the magazine and the paper, which is significantly less expensive. Barnes Review is $56 a year for six big issues, right? American Free Press is $59 for 26 issues. Both of those, I think, drop down to in the $30 range when you just get the electronic edition, which it comes right away. You don't have to worry about the post office delivering the daggone thing. You can get right to reading those publications. So we'll mention the website and ordering information for that later.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, it's quite an honor to be involved with the organization, and it's you know, something I'm very much looking forward to getting involved in. So it's good. It's good to be on board.
Well, it's quite an honor to have anybody want to associate with us.
Yeah, no, it's definitely not easy, you know, especially when you're getting into some of the quite controversial topics that we've been writing about and covering over the years. So,
yeah.
But real quick, the Barnes Review, it was actually founded in 1994.
Correct.
And it's, of course, named after Dr. Harry Elmer Barnes, who is one of the pioneering revisionists going back to World War I, if I'm not mistaken. And its mission really is to bring history into accord with the facts, which I think is a brilliant motto, you know, a brilliant mission statement. And it's something very much lacking amongst the mainstream court historians we see prevailing today.
Absolutely. Let's face it, the media and the historical establishment and the news establishment are all part of the same, you know, conglomerate, we'll say, although the universities are involved in twisting history and teaching their version of history. But what you see and what you read so many times is simply the product of war propaganda. I mean, obviously, our textbooks would have been a bit different had Adolf Hitler won World War II or Joseph Stalin won World War II, right? They would have been saints in shining armor coming in here. But of course, we write our own, and they weren't, but necessarily, as Stalin for sure. But we want to look at the facts and go back to any particular type of event or period in history, going all the way back to the early stages of man up until the nuclear era, all the way up today, which is so much news happening now. And I always tell people if they know a little bit of history, then they kind of understand the news better. And this, what's going on now in Russia and Ukraine is a perfect example of that. Way back in, if people had been subscribing, they could have read in May, June of 2021, when we had our article, front page picture and article on the Crimean War, and predicting there that we knew trouble was coming and that the West had better address the concerns of Vladimir Putin and not let this thing turn into a full-fledged war. And less than 9 months later, these predictions have come true, sadly. And as a matter of fact, everything we try to run in the Barnes Review has some pertinence with what's going on in the news today. As a matter of fact, almost any historical event you can look at has some connection to what happens somewhere because of the way history interweaves itself with the events across the world.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you can really understand anything going on politically today, certainly, you know, in the international realm, without understanding history, without having a proper understanding of history. And that's really where revisionism comes in. And, you know, I kind of view it really as like the concept of free speech and freedom of thought applied to history. You know, it's attempting to take an objective assessment of the historical record viewed from all sides of a particular issue. And in America and in the West in generally, you know, in general, are basically fed a steady diet of totally biased, one-sided historical narratives that frankly do not stand up to scrutiny and often leave out very key details and perspectives of the other side, so to speak.
Sure, sure. And one of the sad things is our politicians are ignorant. They're ignorant of history. They're ignorant of cultures. It's why we won't win a war if we're going to conduct it as we did, and hopefully we don't conduct any, but conduct it as we did in Vietnam without understanding the culture of these people, or to get involved in the nuances between the Ukrainian and Russian conflict. And we send over people like Joe Biden and these idiot diplomats that we have who already have their marching orders from the New World Order as to what they want to see happen, that they don't understand that foreign nations do not want our woke culture forced upon them. They don't want to be de-Christianized in some places. They don't want to have a boot on their neck economically for decades after decades just so the American can maintain its financial hegemony over the world. So when you look at that situation, unless you know about the history of, say, how long the Russians and the Turks and the Europeans and the Indians and others have been, and the people in the Arabian Peninsula, et cetera, all the way up to the Mediterranean, have been fighting over this one little area. And certain areas are extremely strategic. The Crimea is one that is. And have been fighting over this for hundreds and hundreds of years. If they knew the number of wars that Russia had fought just with Turkey alone for control of the Russian Straits leading into the Crimean region,
the Black Sea connecting to the Mediterranean Sea. Yeah, that whole region is very, very strategic.
Yeah, and unless you know that this has been an ongoing conflict and the resolutions that they've come up in the past that haven't worked, we're going nowhere. So, yeah, this is why if politicians would read the Barnes Review or read Honest History publications, because there are a few other ones out there, they might understand the whole situation better and how to handle it.
Right, exactly, yeah. Well, the Barnes Review certainly does cover virtually every aspect of Western history. Obviously, American history, Civil War history has been a major theme over the years, World War I, World War II. But even, you know, even European history prior to World War I, as you mentioned, the Crimea War, the most recent issue is actually the front page, or the cover of the magazine, and then the main lead article is actually an article from Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson about the Russo-Japanese War, separating fact from fiction. And, you know, this is, this war generally is presented as a, you know, like a major devastating defeat for Russia, which isn't entirely true, according to this article, which I thought was very interesting.
There's a lot of things we know of what we've been told about the Russo-Japanese War and generally from our own, again, core historians in the media. But as I read through these articles, I learn something all the time. And so, and Dr. Johnson, of course, is a recognized expert on Slavic affairs, Ukraine, Russia. He translates his own Russian sources into English, so he's learned how to do that. So he's going to primary source material that you're never going to see anywhere else in the West. That being said, reading through that article was just amazing to me that it could have been written about the war going on anywhere today. I think at one point in time he described correspondence between Queen Victoria and Tsar Nicholas II, in which they were both fussing about the media portrayal of each other's countries and how they were portrayed as villains and how they were rallying up the populace for war. And you're like, yeah, that's the same exact thing that's happening today. Or the fact that, and I'll go back and forth between the Crimean War and the Russo-Japanese War, but the Russo-Japanese War in particular, it was actually never fought in Russia or Japan. It was fought in Manchuria, but it was all the cartoons of the era were all portraying Uncle Sam, John Bull, and other European colonial powers pushing the little Japanese soldier to fight the great Russian bear. And it was all about once again, cutting off a financial interest getting involved, besides the fact that Russia did want a portion of China and Japan wanted a portion of China and the Western powers wanted a portion of China. At that time, poor China being relatively prostrate and not being able to defend itself, they just were going to carve that rich economic opportunity zone amongst all the colonial powers. But yeah, so you had Western bankers pushing for war. You had the media rallying up the public. You had an economic war going on at the same time as a physical war. You had massive numbers of civilian casualties, wounded. You had people, you know, the PTSD even then for decades after. You had tens of thousands of people killed. And if this history repeats itself in Ukraine, which it may very well, we're not sure, you could see, if this turns into, for instance, a Western financed insurgency, this thing could go on and kill tens of thousands of people. So in the end, it turns out that this wasn't the devastating defeat that we've been told for so long about Russia. It was just anti-Russian propaganda. And we kind of get an idea of just how long this anti-Russian propaganda has been infiltrating our own history and how it ties in with the goals of the bankers and I guess we call it the New World Order today. Back then, it was the great game, just trying to control resources, control property, hem Russia in. I mean, they've been trying to hem Russia in for 500 years.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was going to bring up. That's really a common theme for certainly the past 300 years, probably even longer than that, is this this idea of trying to isolate Russia and prevent its rise. And that's something that countries like the United Kingdom, America, France, to a certain extent, Germany, you know, everybody's been sort of trying to isolate Russia and prevent its rise. And we see that certainly with this Russo-Japanese War, where America and the British primarily were sort of, you know, egging on, you know, the Japanese to take on the Russians, which is something we saw certainly in World War II with Britain and France and even America to a certain extent sort of manipulating and prodding Poland to stand up to the Germans. And it's exactly what we see now with Ukraine and Russia, where, you know, Ukraine is basically being backed by the West, although the West isn't getting involved militarily. They're sort of sacrificing Ukraine and sort of leaving them out to dry. But it's the same sort of pattern, these Western powers manipulating and egging on some of these smaller, you know, more minor powers to take on the Russians.
Yeah, and worse than that, we're funding the Russians, right? I guess we cut off oil, but Europe is still going to be buying oil from Russia, as far as I understand. And so once again, it's the big business that's going to thrive. And the little guy, the poor civilians who are going to suffer the most, and the soldiers who were sent off to fight and die. But just like in World War I and World War II and every other war, the same financial powers fund both sides because they're looking at profit. And so what always got me was, you know, these decisions are made and nobody really gives a hoot about the civilian population, the people of the country. For instance, the United States, as you and I have discussed so often, very little of what the government does is for our benefit. Same thing what's going on in Ukraine. We could care less about the suffering of the Ukrainian people, in my opinion. It's all about money, and it's all about regional power and neutering Russia as long as we possibly can. And it's such a shame that the major concern of people who run the world really isn't the people of the world. It's just really their own profits.
And absolutely. So
that same thread runs through every war. I mean, we funded the Soviet Union. We made the Soviet Union possible. And Dr. Johnson has talked about that multiple times, and Western capital being absolutely indispensable to the rise and success of the Russian Revolution in the early days of the Soviet Empire and through World War II.
Yeah, I was going to say Lend-Lease, and, you know, we basically supplied the Soviet Union with all sorts of weaponry and, you know, tanks and other heavy equipment all throughout the war.
Yeah.
So. And it's, you know, it's something most people aren't even aware of. And yet, you know, as soon as the war is concluded, all of a sudden the Soviet Union is like this, you know, major enemy, major opponent in the, you know, on the geopolitical sphere. So it turned into, you know, our ally turned into our, you know, main enemy.
We should have seen that one coming.
Yeah, but exactly.
Their troops were ordered to behave in World War II, and the devastation lay left behind amongst the civilian population. But, you know, the Barnes Review is we had in that particular issue that was our lead story. But if you wanted to talk about a few more of those stories, that would be fine too. So give people a little taste of what else we had in that particular issue.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. There's a wide variety of articles in pretty much every edition of the Barnes Review. We got an article by Carl Hammers discussing the role of women in the Reich versus, and it's sort of, you know, comparing it to the Western Marxist inspired ideals of femininity and, you know, the role of women in society, which I thought was very, very interesting. There's a lot of excellent quotes from Hitler and other, you know, top National Socialist leaders, and including, you know, a lot of women leaders at the time. So I thought that was a very, very interesting article and something that's not talked about often. Yeah.
Yeah. Once again, one that ties directly into today, because women, of course, I don't know if you know this. I think you do. But men and women are different, despite
right
in the news all the time. And they're supposed to be different because we're partners, right? We go together. This is why women are generally more patient and better at child rearing, for instance, and they're nurturing, right? Whereas men are bigger and stronger and have testosterone, right? Which makes you a little bit more, I won't say warlike, but a bit more masculine, right? But they've been trying to destroy this in the West for so long. But in Germany, and I would have to say, listen, when they say that Putin's a modern day Hitler, he is probably the better parts of Hitler, right? And we do talk about Adolf Hitler a lot from an uncensored point of view, from personal eyewitnesses to him, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're also vilified, of course, for looking at Hitler as a human being and not as either a saint or a demon. But that being said, Putin, there are some parallels there. But and he, too, is also concerned about this Western perversion of biology. When they say follow the science, nobody's following the science on that side right now. And it's coming back to bite him. I think it's probably just a fad. But in this article, he goes through the number of women who were empowering women. It wasn't disempowering women to have them participate in what they were naturally better than men at, and also to have an equal playing field for in sports and other things where they weren't competing against each other like they are now, which is absolutely
right. Deep. Speaking of that, did you see that transgender swimmer was named? I don't know if it was if it was actually real, but named like Woman of the Year, and it, you know, is getting all these awards and stuff.
I did see that. My wife even said to me,
unbelievable.
Now they're even taking our sports awards. And so,
it's crazy.
And this is what Hitler was concerned about. And the Soviet Union, by the way, in the early, I know it's in the early days or during the war, they had a need for workers. But they also, too, had that communist idea that men and women were kind of equal. They didn't go as far as to say they were the same gender. But that the women could do anything, and they were kind of breaking apart that traditional family unit.
Well, that's what it's all about. Yeah, this Marxist strategy is really just designed to undermine the traditional family, and sure, it's had devastating consequences in the West, just in the matter of a generation.
But Hitler also had great respect for these women. There was three or four really big women leaders, but they were involved in, according to one, I think her name was, it may have been the quote from Frau Gertrude Schultz, right?
Right.
Schultz-Klink, yes. She said that women were involved in helping men solve the great problems of the day. They weren't being left behind. They weren't being asked to lift 250 pounds. They were doing what they were naturally good at. And he gave awards for it. He had a great admiration for his own mother, Hitler. And it was in stark contrast to the gender dysphoria, the blurring of gender lines now, which really is a Marxist idea, considering only like a 0.1% of the American population has this, right? With the way we hear about it, it's like 50% of the American population wants to become the other sex, which is crazy. But I thought it was a very interesting and telling article, and a relatively detailed article, simply on the difference between what you might look as a rational approach to the relationships between the genders and the irrational approach that they're taking today, which we all know is nuts.
Yes, absolutely. And motherhood was very much emphasized and encouraged and praised, which sadly we really don't see in America, in the modern American society anyways.
Yeah, of course,
it's viewed as like a burden, and you know, it's going to ruin your life. You know, I mean, you see people saying stuff like this, like, oh no, you're going to have children and it's going to take over your life, and you know, going to have no free time and stuff. It's just a totally unnatural way of looking at the situation, unhealthy way of looking at the situation. It should be celebrated, and motherhood should be elevated and looked as, you know, one of the most important aspects of life.
Sure, and Hitler's critics would have said, well, he just was trying to get these women to breed, these breeders, to give us more soldiers for the Reich. But that's not really it. They had it kind of figured out that each German family should have 4 children to account for losses, civilian losses, and others, because not all the kids would fight and not all of them were men. But also because that's the number needed to expand the population. And so today we're at a point where we see the white population, of course, diminishing because of this selfish attitude that we have. Of course, children change your life. Of course, they suck up all your energy and your money. That's what they're supposed to do. Right? If you're not ready for that, but it does change your life. But he saw that as just an extremely important part, whereas others were. And I don't remember, and I could be wrong, so I don't know what Hitler's view on abortion was. People always say he was a huge abortionist, but really I think he was, that may have been part of his euthanasia program earlier on that he stopped. But, you know, just he had, and it's so crazy that the most evil man in history, according to the court historians, had such common sense views on the survival of culture. And I think Putin does understand that. People also say Hitler was super anti-Christian, right? We've run articles on this. He thought it was extremely important to have some religious faith in the population. There's new, he couldn't do anything about Christianity. He just wanted the Christian churches to put out the National Socialist propaganda line, which some of them didn't like to do. But he understood that it was important. And so does Putin, too, which Putin over there in Russia doesn't like people, you know, crazy leftist, radical, punk rock groups defecating on the altars of churches.
That disgusting Femin group.
Sure, whatever it may be. I mean, this is what a leader is for. A leader is really, and the way it's supposed to work in the United States, right, is we have a constitutional republic and our rights are enshrined in a document. It's really the president's job to make sure that those rights are not being infringed upon. And therefore, he vetoes bills, allegedly, that would take away our rights, infringe on our rights, or endanger our rights. But that's not the way it works anymore. Now our president says that there are no inviolable rights, that nothing in the Bill of Rights, for instance, is written in stone. So looking at Putin and looking at Hitler, and by the way, their invasion of Poland and Ukraine, we can talk about some other time, do bear a great relationship in a desire for the leader of a country to look out for his people.
Right.
His ethnic speaking people. And so, yeah, there are some parallels there. But I think people enjoy the article on National Socialist Women because people also have this idea that the German women were around for nothing but reproducing more super soldiers. And it's complete.
Right. That's a very like Hollywood-esque understanding of the situation.
Absolutely.
Right. John Weir had an article about Sophie Scholl and the White Rose Movement, which is presented in the West, definitely in Germany, as like this courageous, heroic organization that was resisting the evil Nazis, which, of course, you know, obviously there's much more to the story. And this is a pretty good overview of her and just the movement in general. They were, in fact, arrested and executed by the German government during the war. So pretty interesting story, I thought.
Sure. Yeah, Sophie Scholl, I think we said in that article, was voted one of the top 5 greatest Germans of all of history. Yet very few people have heard of her outside of Germany because they have a very good propaganda machine going on there, right, to keep these Germans in line and make sure they never want to take over the world again, you know. But
right.
But I hadn't heard of this too much. And so once again, something you learn there. I mean, she was a courageous girl. She didn't like Hitler. As she grew up, and they were originally a member of the Hitler Youth with her brother. Her brother and one of their friends were also executed at the time because they had been putting out flyers against Hitler. But they crossed the line when they started advocating for a sabotage of the German war effort.
Oh, open sabotage, right.
Right. So even during World War II, we all remember that we had the America First Committee with Charles Lindbergh and General Wood and a couple others that off the top of my head escaped me. But the minute the war started, they stopped their activity and they said, we can't stop the war now. So we're going to have to fight on the side of the United States. So I guess if the America First Committee had decided to advocate for open sabotage of the American war effort, they would have been executed too. So at that point in time, we look at her as not such a great hero, but someone who was misplacing her efforts. So, but there were people who, and they were good intentioned people, who didn't like Hitler and didn't like the aspects of his regime. So I thought it was a relatively even-handed article. We're not saying she was horrible. We're just saying at the end, our conclusion is that I don't think that she is one of the top five German heroes of all time.
No, absolutely not. Mark Rowland wrote a very interesting review of Heinrich Himmler. British historian David Irving actually just wrote a book, a biography of Heinrich Himmler, and this was Mark Rowland's review. And of course, Himmler is probably second to Hitler, one of the most demonized men of World War II. And obviously, there's much more to the story. And he was a pretty righteous and courageous individual that goes all the way back to the founding of the party, if I'm not mistaken. You know, he was involved in the National Socialist Movement from the very beginning and played a huge role in World War II.
Yes, he's one who's gotten, you know, the Hitler treatment, meaning that
Right. You
can't say anything good about him or anything even neutral about him. It's kind of like the same thing you're experiencing today, right? John, what's happened today is that the whole world is experiencing the Holocaust denial treatment. Okay, at one point in time, it was just Holocaust deniers who were the horrible people who were to be booted. And by the way, I mention this because obviously
Heinrich Himmler, yeah.
I'm sorry, what they say. Don't say yes, Himmler is associated with the Holocaust because he's allegedly one of the architects of it. We know that this isn't necessarily true. They're a mainstream depiction of the Holocaust and this grand plan to exterminate the European Jewry. But anyway, that being said, today we're finding out now that that they've using that term denial for a lot of stuff, including COVID denial, right? Or a COVID vaccine denier or anything like it. It's funny that Putin has kind of turned this on its head by saying that he's going in to wipe out Nazis, right, in Germany.
In Ukraine.
Because nobody can object to that nowadays, right? And drug addicts. Right? We know there's a drug addiction problem in the United States. So everybody now, but my point being that now people who even point out facts like about Himmler, I almost forgot his name again. I keep wanting to say Goering or Goebbels. People that point out facts about him that might be true are evil racists. So now we find out that even people that point out facts about, say, biolabs in Ukraine are evil racists and Russia deniers or Russian stooges. It's the same old smear campaign. It's just that now it's gotten super wide where everybody, they just attached the word denier on the end of it. And they made such publicity about Holocaust deniers that the term denier itself, without the word Holocaust associated with it, has become very powerful on its own.
Right. So, yeah. It's one of these totally weaponized words.
Right. So
that is used very effectively.
So I guess I would like peace in Ukraine and Russia, and I guess I'm a peace denier, right? Because there can't be peace over there. It's got to be war. We've got to beat this evil Putin, and these poor Ukrainians have to be armed to the teeth so that their 12-year-old children can go out and fight the Russians, and so can Grandma. It's absolutely crazy. But anyway, it's interesting. The article on Himmler was good because it gave us a different view on Himmler. Do we agree with everything that David Irving said about him? No. As a matter of fact, the book review had a few problems with the book. But I thought what struck me at the end was what a family man Himmler was, right? He's pictured there with his family and a family friend on a fishing trip. He hated hunting. He and Hitler both hated hunting. Goering loved hunting, evidently. They didn't want to kill the animals and all this stuff. Does this sound like the kind of guy
Right. The
mass murder of millions of people?
Exactly. Well, and he also adopted, I believe he was an SS officer's child.
Yes.
Who had died in the war. I'm forgetting exactly the details. I know he adopted a child that was...
Well, he died during the assault, during the...
I think it was prior to World War II, actually. Yeah, it was like, you know, in the political struggle leading up to
Right. The
National Socialists taking over. But yeah, so I mean, clearly a family man, somebody that cared deeply about the country, cared deeply about its culture and history, and was not this evil monster that the mainstream has presented him as.
Yeah, and that particular portrayal must stay in place because...
Well, it's really the bedrock of our entire, you know, historical paradigm, you know, in the modern world.
Well,
everything revolves around like the official narrative of World War II and the Holocaust, and you know, the Germans were like these evil monsters that wanted to take over the world. So much of what we see today is a direct result of this official understanding of World War II, which is entirely false and, you know, does not stand up to any sort of scrutiny. You know, and again, that's why I think publications like the Barnes Review are so critical.
Absolutely. There's very few of us left. I always thought that the real secret about Hitler that they were trying to hide from you, and the Holocaust was actually a smokescreen, was the fact that a man can take over a destitute country that's paying a million marks or whatever for a head of cabbage and seeing it double to 2 million tomorrow. I'm exaggerating. And can turn that nation around in less than 10 years by doing four or five simple things. Getting control of your money system, right? Getting control of the media to some degree. I'm not saying for censorship necessarily, but there are really dangerous news outlets there in the mainstream that not only foment for war, but also fill people's heads with absolute lies. Those types of news organizations are dangerous. So you do a few more things, and before you know it, you've turned your country around. Like, be concerned about the people of your country, not about the 2 million people you're allowing in illegally across the southern border in the case of the United States.
Exactly. So, well, that's another parallel to what we see going on today with Putin and Russia. You know, Hitler is never – like when you're learning about Hitler in school or at university, no one is actually ever reading what the man had to say. No one's ever reading Mein Kampf, for example, or listening to or reading any of his speeches that he gave, or really looking at any of his policies that he was implementing. It's all just this emotional, hysterical, over-the-top demonization – portraying him as this evil monster that wanted to murder all the Jews and all the, you know, they have all sorts of different narratives about, you know, the undesirables and the Untermensch and, you know, all these sort of buzzwords. But it's really just designed to prevent you from actually looking at what this man stood for. And the same is true with Putin today. I mean, you can't even find any of his speeches online. Definitely not in, you know, the mainstream media. You can go on like YouTube and some of these other alternative, you know, video sharing platforms and listen to his speech and, read his speech. You can actually go to the Kremlin's website and read it in English. But it's not something that is going to be reported on by the mainstream media. And, you know, we're seeing Russian news outlets just being shut down and censored left and right. In addition, you know, it's part of this canceling of Russia in general.
Well, so it's come back full circle now that we're talking about censoring us Holocaust deniers. Now they're censoring censoring presidents of the United States and entire countries.
Right.
This is our new weapon. We don't want to get involved in a shooting war with Russia. What we want to do is bring in the bankers in their pinstripe suits, and they'll deal with them. And they'll do what they can. And I think once Putin and Xi and North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, Brazil, India figure a way to get out of this financial new world order we're in, we're cooked.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So we've learned.
Well, I think it's very revealing that these two very demonized men, Putin and Hitler, I mean, they do not want you to actually listen to what these men have to say. You know, I mean, that's very clear. That's why you see this just hysterical demonization of both of them. They don't want anybody to actually entertain and really recognize and understand what these men actually stand for and what the points that they're making.
And,
you know, because I think if you do, they'll resonate with you and you'll realize that they had a lot of very good ideas and a lot of very good points, frankly.
Yeah, I mean, like I say, they want everybody censored, all the way from an ex-MMA fighter, Joe Rogan, all the way up to the president of the United States and the president of Russia. I mean, have they become stronger than governments? And I was wondering exactly what type of influence private entities can bring to wars outside of nations nowadays, when you control the internet, when you control iPhones or however you do it, or the satellites like Elon Musk, or if you're a rich guy like George Soros, who might be able to just pick up a couple billion dollars worth of weapons and dump them in a country outside of all national law. So, like, yes, at this point in time, you have to wonder exactly how much power the extra governmental organizations possess these days.
Right.
Kind of scary. They're not allowed by anybody, but
Exactly.
What did you have after Sophie Scholl there? There was a good one after that one. I mean, so we had Sophie.
Remy Treblay had one of the most interesting articles, in my opinion anyways, in this entire issue. And he was talking about the sort of like the purging of the French right, you know, during World War II and you know, certainly afterwards. And this is, you know, kind of a theme that you see all throughout the Western world is, you know, leading up to World War II and certainly afterwards, just a total purging of any sort of nationalist, populist type thinkers, intellectuals, journalists, certainly politicians. Christians, you know, it was a sort of like Marxist, communist takeover of the entire Western world. And, you know, we certainly see this, you know, in America, like in the university systems, in our politics. There was just an elimination of anybody that was a nationalist and a populist. And this article specifically focuses on France. Which I thought was very interesting. Remy is he's a French Canadian, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So he has a much more detailed knowledge of, you know, French politics and French history than most American academics.
Correct. And, you know, this was interesting. We have discussed this at times before in the long history of the Barnes Review, which has been publishing, as you mentioned, since 1994. So we literally have, 28 years of magazines, but so we do repeat topics occasionally because history repeats itself. But that being said, once again, this was an article that has direct correlation with what's going on today. This was cancel culture run wild in basically post World War II France.
Right. It was a purge led by, frankly, communists. Yeah.
Yes.
Against, you know, any sort of resistance, any sort of political or intellectual resistance.
But isn't it interesting who they chose to attack?
Some of the top French writers, yeah, and journalists and intellectuals.
But going after the poets, it's like they went after Ezra Pound. What is it that they hate so much about poets? It's just interesting who they went after and who they. I mean, some of these people did a lot more incendiary writing than these guys, but these guys were well-known people. And of course, remember that a lot of these Frenchmen, when the Vichy government, I think it was popularly elected at one point in time, whatever it was not an illegal government. And so people afterwards said, well, the Germans are here, they got this government in place, it's been passed, and we're just going to live in it. Well, if you did that, you were a collaborator, basically.
Right.
To write your or say anything that was not condemnatory of the Nazis or whatever. Then when the time came, this orgy of revenge. Once again, in a previous issue, we just ran something very similar about the French Revolution being an assault on Christianity, the existing order, the aristocracy, and the Christian monarchs. Sound familiar? Well, sure. You had the Russian Revolution happened just, you know, a century later, I guess it was, or so, 120 years later. And now you have, once again, we're going through the same thing here in the United States where history repeats itself and we have an assault on Christianity. You have a purging of the right. You have attacks on anyone in the literary or film industry who dares deviate from the pre-approved line that the wokeitarian line will say. Anybody who espouses Christian beliefs is no good. Anyone who says that America first is the way to go is crazy. Anyone that says we shouldn't be involved in foreign wars is a Russian stooge, or fill in the country name if you like. And so it's very similar to what's going on there. The only thing is that we aren't being executed just yet. We are being imprisoned here and there, especially in foreign countries in Europe. In the United States, we still have the First Amendment for as long as we can hold on to it, but it's being whittled away as we speak. And by the way, it's being whittled away in many states by conservatives who are passing laws about anti-Semitism. And so really, this is did the French purge ever really stop? It just kind of got bigger, you know what I mean? And so we're in the midst of, I guess you could have called that a 1940s cancel culture. But evidently, if you think about it, John, cancel culture has probably been around for thousands of years. Look what they did to King Tut after he died, and they wiped he and his father out of history. And they can't, that the first massive cancel culture operation, right? They just chipped him out of all the monuments and everything else. So we deal with this, but the way to handle it is to keep telling the truth. Because inevitably, it will resonate with people. Because how many times over the years, and I'm sure this has happened to you multiple times, I will watch the news with somebody and say, well, that's total BS. This is what's really going to happen. They're like, you're crazy. And then 6 months later, because we know a little bit of history and we know a little bit about cultures and how things work, those things that we said came true. And people are like, you were right. And I'm like, of course we were right.
Right, yeah.
So this is why it's so important to read history magazines. It's a fun history magazine, too. It's just not all text. It's highly illustrated and interesting sidebars. And we have a great letter section and items on the little history items you might have missed, maybe 15 or 20 of those in a two-page spread. There's something for everybody in there, although it is for the open-minded reader.
Right, exactly. Well, and a good example of that is this article by Mike Walsh, The Porcelain Masterworks of the Third Reich, which includes a number of photographs. And this was a topic that I was not at all familiar with. So again, you know, you'd pick up any edition of the Barnes Review, you're going to learn something new. And this was, you know, a prime example in my case anyways.
Well, let's face it, Barnes Review is a Caucasian white centric magazine. There's plenty of magazines out there, Ebony and La Raza Illustrated Monthly or whatever they have, you know, for other groups. But it's almost impossible now for you to create a magazine about white culture without being called a racist. That being said, it's part of our mission is not only to bring history in accord with the facts, but educate people about their own past and to try to counter this barrage of guilt that they have hit us with and hit our people with. I don't know, since the 1960s at the very least, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, this white guilt goes back to World War II, in my opinion, at least to a large degree, certainly in Germany, but even, you know, in other Western nations. And like the mainstream portrayal of history in general, American history, for example, with, you know, colonialism and slavery, it's all extremely one-sided and weaponized against white people, frankly.
Yeah. And listen, we can admit we've been wrong a lot. Okay. We've been right a lot, and we've created some of the greatest things that this world has to offer, and we've given it away for free, practically. Well, wait a second. They say, you were bought slaves or whatever it may have been. I said, well, first of all, you don't know the whole history of that. Secondarily, you don't know who the worst slavers were. And third, my family never owned any slaves. So let's get the history straight. But that being said, the article on porcelain by Mike Walsh. Mike Walsh is a very popular European writer. He's probably in his 60s or 70s now. He's been writing for many, many years, has some super politically incorrect books, was recently canceled off of Amazon, as have many of the groups that we work with. But he is specifically interested in the artistic heights that the Third Reich reached in multiple arenas. This particular one was in the porcelain works.
Right. Yeah.
And so you have it's just like I said early on about cultures. It's nice to have an art background that I have because you can see the different manifestations of the culture and how far they go. For instance, these porcelain works are absolutely gorgeous, some of them. I mean, just so delicately done, and the crafting of them and the sculpting of them and the painting of them. But not only that, the proper firing of them, the limited quantities, the craftsmen they had that did it, that what it meant to the German people or European people to see these repeated motifs of, you know, spring, summer, winter, fall, particular Teutonic gods, right? Some of our own past pets they would do, great heroes of history. And I imagine we were the same way, although we were putting stuff out at the McCrory's for a nickel. But the way we used to collect busts of George Washington, right? Or Abraham Lincoln, no matter what you think of him, he was a popular modern souvenir collector's dream, right? But we don't do that anymore. I mean, everybody had a picture. I imagine people in Russia might have a picture of Putin if they like him. Not everybody likes him, but I'm sure people had pictures of Hitler and pictures of the leader and Mussolini and even pictures of Churchill, right? And FDR. My mother, we always had a picture of the president. Whoever the president was, we had one in the house. Well, that stopped after we stopped liking our presidents too much, right? And that was basically with Kennedy. Okay, he was the last guy, I think, or maybe Reagan. Reagan was popular. But at any rate, that just reflected, these porcelain works really reflect the German people and the pride they had in their cultural motifs and their regional outfits and everything. So again, not specifically, I don't know if we can say this is specifically bringing history into core with the facts, but it's an art lesson for you in here and to try to bring some culture into this world.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very interesting. A lot of very good photos and, you know, images of some of these pieces of art. It's fascinating. Very, very detailed, very impressive. The last article is another book review, actually, and this is Sean McMeekin's recent book, Stalin's War, which is, I mean, this guy is like a mainstream academic, yet this book that he published, which is available on Amazon and in, you know, pretty much any mainstream bookstore, is quite a revisionist take on World War II and the role that Stalin played, and he sort of presents Stalin as the main perpetrator of World War II, and certainly the main benefactor of World War II.
Absolutely. And so we've been on this point for many years, and we've had Suvorov's Icebreaker, and we've had Stalin's War of Extermination, and now we have Stalin's War. And I think it's called A New Take or A New Look at World War II by McMeekin. You mentioned McMeekin was a mainstream scholar. He is, because he does take a very mainstream line on Adolf Hitler being the most evil character around, or maybe the second most evil, because he does believe that Stalin, that what Stalin did would have made Hitler blush. But it's still a dangerous point of view for a scholar to take in this day and age, in the cancel culture age, because of how simply you could be smeared. However, when you listen to McMeekin talk in his lectures, he's extremely reasonable, he's smart, he's funny, and he's a difficult guy to attack, especially if he keeps on with the gas chamber line on the Holocaust. Again, a topic for another day, because people may say, what are you talking about? But we have an extensive Holocaust library, and we do nitpick with the court historian's line on the Holocaust. But that being said,
nitpick, I think it's a little bit more strident than that, but yeah.
nitpicking with a sledgehammer. But,
yeah.
But
I was going to say it's pretty much a systematic debunking of the mainstream narrative, but go ahead.
I can't, too. But anyway, McMeekin and others, including Suvorov and our own historians who have read other vast numbers of works on World War II, realize that our Operation Barbarossa was not an offensive, necessarily, really, I'm not wording this just right, but an offensive attack, but a defensive one, meaning that the Soviet Union was well ready to invade the West and possibly overrun the place. It sounds ridiculous, but no, they were a lot more powerful and organized at the time than people give them credit for. And so McMeekin is saying, who ended up with all half of Europe? Well, the Soviets did. Stalin did. And who ended up with manufacturing and free gifts by Lend-Lease and others? Who ended up with investments? Who ended up with ruling and atomic weaponry, right, that was stolen from us? So McMeekin says that World War II obviously not only turned out well for Stalin, but he was manipulating events quite well to make sure that this war turned out the way he wanted it to, as we all
right, exactly.
But we didn't want it to turn out like he did, but the United States became his ally. So it just kind of points out underscores the mistake that the United States made intervening in World War II at all. People will say, well, listen, if Stalin was the wrong guy, why didn't we fight with Hitler? Well, we shouldn't have been there at all. That's why.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it's interesting because the subtitle is A New History of World War II. And it sort of is. I mean, at least from a mainstream perspective, you know, this idea, this, you know, the central role that Stalin and the Soviet Union played in World War II and instigating and sort of certainly benefiting from the aftermath is not really presented in, you know, in a mainstream setting. You have to turn to, the revisionist community to get that perspective.
I guess you would say that, but I can only say that other people outside the mainstream have been on this topic for quite some time.
Exactly. Yeah.
McMeekin can be patted on the back for his analyses and books on the Soviet Union. For instance, one of his better books, and I think maybe his bestseller, not sure, was Chief Culprit, right? Was it McMeekin who wrote that? But anyway, it was a book that he wrote on, if it wasn't that one, it's another, on the looting that the Soviets did. Of course, all we hear about is the trainloads of gold and rare artworks that the Nazis actually took from cities they were either going to be bombed or somebody else was going to be bombed and protected them in salt mines, but that's a different story. But that's all we ever hear. And we even have like the Monument Men, and we had what's that big movie they made about, it was the Monuments Men, where these guys go back and find all this art. Well, what the Soviet generals took and what the Soviets looted from there, and this is one of McMeekin's topics, I believe, dwarfed what the Russians did. As a matter of fact, we had an article by one of our authors, I believe it was John Ware, talking about the massive trial and purging of Soviet generals who were just waltzing around Europe lining their pockets without giving Stalin his cut. So McMeekin is to be congratulated for talking honestly about the Soviet Union.
Yes, absolutely. And this book, it was recently published, I think just last year. It is available from the Barnes Review bookstore as well, so you can pick it up directly from the Barnes Review, I wanted to point out.
Right. And just to give David Irving a plug, if you were interested in the Himmler book, The True Himmler, then take a look at look up David Irving's website online. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head, Global Focus or something like that, and help him too, because he's been put through the ringer over the years with court cases and defamation and attacks and publishing houses, et cetera, et cetera, have gone after him, all because he has tried to, in his own way, bring history in accord with the facts, his specialty being going back to these archives and just delving through the information in the archives that no historian wants to do because it's so much work.
Exactly, yep.
So I would support him and support anybody that's trying to put out some honest history.
Yes, especially the Barnes Review. And you can go to the website, you can either go to barnesreview.com or barnesreview.org. It'll take you to the same place. And you can subscribe. There's a subscribe to TBR button right there at the top. So check that out. And also there's a huge, huge library of books for sale as well.
Right. And you know what? We've been at this for quite some time. And the one thing I can say is Willis Cardo was a producer. He was probably one of the most prolific nationalist publishers in American history. Yet only 1% of the population has ever heard of the guy. And it's because he talked about what once were acceptable topics, but today and slowly but surely during his tenure until he passed away, I believe in 2015, have become what we call politically incorrect. Political incorrectness in itself is a Bolshevik concept, right? It stops us from talking about important topics. If we can't talk about important topics, then we can't make any progress, right?
Well, and not only that, but we don't live in a free society either. If we can't even openly discuss these perspectives and topics.
Yeah. So so we have hundreds of books. We publish our own books. We have the website. We have articles. We're expanding, trying to expand all the time. Always fighting off the wolves that want us out of business. And if you read the Barnes Review, the thing is, it's like not shocking to me. Because the scholars we have talking about this know what they're talking about and talk about it from a very believable and
respectable and even scholarly to a certain extent. I mean, it's absolutely a very legitimate perspective. Yeah.
I wouldn't say unbiased is my point. And yeah, some of these guys are legit scholars and researchers, as a matter of fact. And they're dying off, the older guys, just like they are everywhere. Because, John, I hate to tell you, but you don't know nothing until you're 60. I'm 61 now, so I changed that from 50. But, yeah, there's just so much to look at on all periods in history, and everything needs to be revised because everything has a financial or political twist. Even if you read an ancient history book, you know. Now, look, myths are important. And, like, I'm not one to argue with teaching kids are myths, as long as we know that they're myths, like George Washington chopping down the cherry tree and throwing the silver dollar across the river. And I'm not against teaching the honest history, even if it's about white people, even if it makes us look bad. I don't focus on that, as I say, because everybody's focusing on that on today. So we're not scared of the truth. Like Jefferson said, right, there's no truth of which I'm scared for people to know about. I have certainly botched that, and it's not the exact quote, but you get the point. He wasn't scared of the truth. And so I think that people are scared of the truth. They don't even want to know. They don't even want people to see what they're reading or whisper to when they talk because of how they've convinced us all that those of us who have questions about any aspect of history are some type of evil, some type of cancer. And it's baloney, and it's going to come around, and this is a trend, and people will once again respect the quest for honest history. And it's one we've been on for 28 years and plan to go as long as we can. So once again, I just want to say we're glad you're involved in it, and younger people are getting involved in it. We want to get younger and younger and more vibrant all the time, and keep this thing going as long as we can. And we can't do that if people don't help us, because this is a business. This isn't a volunteer operation. And so take a look at those books, subscribe to the magazine, think about that print magazine, think about getting that PDF for, I think it's $36, which is $20 less, and read it for a few. I mean, what are our PDFs going for online? A couple of bucks? Try it out. See if you like it. Request a free sample copy. Tell them you heard and call the, we'll give you the number, but the best number to call is 202-544-5977. They might answer through a central switchboard. Just request a copy of the Barnes Review and see if you like it. If you like it, subscribe.
Absolutely. I've been a subscriber since 2010, I think. And yeah, it's something that anybody that's interested in genuine, authentic history, you know, in revisionism in general, should be subscribing to the Barnes Review.
Sure. And you may roll your eyes or say, I can't believe this, but give it time. Or go check it out yourself. That's the problem with today is, and with people, is we're inundated with so much fake news and fake history that it's almost hard now with the censorship going on to find these original sources, to find people who've been there. I mean, I like it when we have Russian experts writing about Russian history, people who know about it. But what you find online a lot of times is guys in their basement just chitter-chattering and not really knowing what they're talking about, and people listening to them and taking their opinion for gospel. So here's a tried and true organization that's been around for a long time that makes sure that everything we say, we don't have to run a correction on the next issue.
Right. All right. Very good. Well, thanks a lot, Paul. I appreciate you taking the time. Hopefully we'll be doing this on a regular basis. And yeah, once again, I'd encourage everybody to check out the website, barnesreview.com or barnesreview.org. And consider subscribing if you do not already.
Yeah, and a great, I just throw in at the end there that you trust TBR for your history, you can trust American Free Press for your news. And so they make a great combination. If you call the 800 line, ask them for, see if you can get a package deal for the two of them, and tell them Paul Angel tells you you get $15 off or something. We'll make sure you get a decent deal on getting both those publications or one or the other.
All right, very good.
Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you, sir. We'll talk to you soon.
You got it. Bye-bye.